I'm Chris Reback. Today we continue our series of conversations with InTandem managing partner Elliot Cooperstone. What is the InTandem approach? In our first conversation, Elliot gave us the overview, the firm's general approach to investing in healthcare services companies, in particular, the close ways in which the team partners with entrepreneurs and management from the start. In fact, Elliot explained how InTandem's differentiated approach begins even before the start, at the pre-investment stage. He discussed the role of trust and what that means for both sides of the relationship. And he concluded by touching on what happens once the investment is complete, how that's not the end of anything, but rather the start of a deeper relationship between InTandem executives and company leaders, a relationship Elliot described as playing, quote, on the field, as an on-field player coach as opposed to a press box coach. But what exactly does that approach look like? How does it work? And why is it useful and attractive for company management? In our next series of conversations, we dig into those questions with Elliot, the immediate priorities in determining what needs to get done after InTandem closes an investment. We'll address this in three parts: the what, the how, and the who. Specifically, what comprises that winning strategy? How that strategy gets operationalized, how the vision gets put into action every day, and finally, who makes up the short and medium-term needs in terms of a top-notch, whole-brain team. So let's turn now to Elliot and begin with the first of these elements. What makes up the winning strategy? Elliot, thanks for joining me. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, too.
So let's set the stage. You had an investment thesis. You had a desired sector. You found a target investment. And now, after months, maybe longer, of meetings, discussions, financial reviews, trust building, start stops, finally, success. The investment is complete. What happens now after, of course, I hope, a round of handshakes and toasts? What happens?
Well, you know, yes, handshakes, toasts. We're also huggers at the firm. So, you know,
hugging is good. Hugging's always good.
We do really savor the moment, but we are recognizing, even in that celebration, that it's just the beginning. We have managed to get ourselves to the start line, and the hard work is really only ahead of us at that point.
My guess is that you absolutely enjoy and respect the celebration, and that after about 15 minutes of that, you and the management team are really focused on what's next. So can you take me through that? Why does a clear strategy and plan matter? You've invested in a company, and I assume that company already has been doing something well. Otherwise, you surely wouldn't have invested. So what happens now?
At the outset of an investment, it's absolutely critical that the company strategy be well articulated, and that the processes that are necessary to affect that strategy be well defined, and just as important, that the organization is structured properly so that the strategy can be successful. But I think it's also important to recognize that even where a company that we have acquired has successfully grown to be a market leader, we're usually making an investment because together we see an opportunity to accelerate growth, you know, to take on some new path. And there is going to be a whole series of changes associated with that.
There is going to be new pacing. There are going to be acquisitions and new strategy. That's kind of, I would assume, part of the whole point.
It's very much a part of our sales effort, trying to convince some sellers to partner with us. It's very much a part of the due diligence as we test our own investment thesis with the sellers themselves. But you can be sure by the time we get to the finish line of the transaction and the start line to our future relationship, there is a common set of ideas about how we are going to take the company forward from a strategic point of view. Frankly, in most companies, even large Fortune 500 companies, the company strategy and how the organization works to optimize that strategy is often not sufficiently well-defined and not really well-communicated to the entire staff. And we have some central beliefs that motivate us to spend a lot of time up front to make sure that we are re-articulating the strategy and refocusing on how to execute that strategy in a way that creates the foundation for the company's growth.
How do business owners react when you talk to them about these ideas and about these ways of going forward? They've been successful entrepreneurs. They've been successful business people. What's the reaction you get when you talk to them about these ideas?
It really does depend on the individual. But if I were to generalize, I would say that entrepreneurs don't necessarily like taking the time at the outset to slow down and focus on some of these planning elements. You know, they've had a lot of success generally by competing on speed. And, you know, they're accustomed to very often a command and control like approach to managing, where they can literally yell down the hall, change direction, and have the result of that change go on 5 minutes later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it served them well. It brought them to the point where it created our interest in the company. So it's hard to argue with the approach that's made them successful, at least in their mind, until you realize that with the sort of growth that will come together through our partnership, no one's going to be able to yell down the hall and change anything for very much longer. The organization is likely to get more complex, more distributed. It's very likely that at some point in the near future after our investment, there'll be people in the company that the CEO not only did not hire, but never even met. So the whole dynamic of planning and then communicating well enough so that execution is effective, you know, that really requires a rethinking for how that is meant to happen in the organization going forward. And once the entrepreneur starts to understand that and realize that, what they come to understand is that we're only slowing down momentarily to create a foundation that will ultimately allow us to move much more quickly than if that foundation were not there.
It sounds like a real opportunity to transition, and I hate the cliche, but it's what sounds like it's happening, to transition to a new level, that the entrepreneur has gotten the business, just what you said, to the point where it's at, to the point where you are interested, and maybe others are interested as well, to the point where they have been highly successful, but now they're engaging with you on a new path and an augmented path, and taking the moment to get organized around that transition sounds like it's an important thing to do.
It really is, and your reference to the concept of level is right on the money. So we actually do think of companies in levels 1 through 5, and 1 would be, you know, the entrepreneurial splendor of the beginning days when it is very much a command and control type of environment. And for us, level 5, we would refer to as a team of leaders, where the CEO becomes more of the conductor of an orchestra, and the different groups within the orchestra are almost self-managed, but in a highly coordinated way. And it's a journey to get from level 1 to level 5, but it's a deliberate journey in the case of our portfolio companies.
You know what's so interesting about what you just said? So many people you would think in business would say, well, level 5, that's the end. That's where, you know, we all say goodbye. That's where there's an IPO, whatever an exit is. You are really focused on helping a company turn into a well-managed, proficient, organized, next level firm, and really, really help it graduate, because everything you're talking about is about helping accelerate and grow the organization and the management of the company.
I would agree. That is our primary objective, our view.
Why do you focus so much on that component?
Because all the other stuff you cannot really predict or plan on. Nothing is guaranteed. How long we'll hold an investment, what might happen in the marketplace generally, what competitors may wake up one day and start doing, how regulators may change the environment on us. We can't really plan for, you know, a date certain in the future to achieve X, Y, and Z. But what we can do is plan to build the very best possible company, the highest performing management team, the most loyal and motivated employee base. And if we can create that kind of excellence over time, then we can optimize based on everything else that happens, even though those things may be beyond our control.
And we've talked about this before. we don't need to get totally into it, but it sounds like yet another example of your acting and Tandem's acting as that player coach. Maybe this is a little bit more on the coaching side than the playing side, but it feels like it's part of that overall relationship that you have described as differentiating, but you know, just part of who in Tandem is and how you behave.
I'd like to think so. And certainly our view is that the only way to get from level one to level five is through a lot of thinking and learning and then applying that learning really effectively. Very hard to do without a group of partners who have been there before and understand where we're trying to go and are willing to wade in up to our necks and not just describe it, but actually do it next to our partners so that people can learn through experience. But over time, you know, I think an interesting dynamic is the more that we are successful, the more capable the team becomes, the more able they are to lead, perhaps with less intensive support from us. And as time goes by and that support diminishes, we view that as a sign of not just the company's success, but our success as well.
Do you have processes, tools, anything to kind of help facilitate and build on that foundation?
We do. We have a really extensive library of tools that we use. And in that library are not just the tools themselves, but lots of examples of how those tools have been developed and customized for each individual situation. So we are not starting from scratch. We're starting with a great inventory of templates and frameworks and other kinds of tools that we can work from. At the beginning, the tools really become relevant in different measures through the different stages of the investment. So, for example, at the beginning of the investment, we're generally focused on three or four really critical tools: the 100-day plan, the strategic intent document, the message map, and the communication mechanisms would be the, generally speaking, the four things that we're focused on coming right out of the gate.
Let's talk about each of them. Let's start with the 100-day plan. Is there a framework? What is it comprised of? What happens on day one?
Well, there are many initiatives and activities that naturally arise at the time that an acquisition is completed. For example, there may be transitions in the finance function if we're switching from cash basis to accrual accounting. There may be a new lender on the scene that requires compliance and financial reporting. There may be a new acquisition that's been identified and is ready to go and suddenly actionable. So, you know, even though we've showed up, and sometimes because we've showed up, nobody's stopping the day-to-day imperatives of the business that existed before the transaction was closed. So things will feel really busy, which requires good prioritization and really effective resourcing, all of which requires good planning. So we use this tried and true 100-day plan, at least start with the template of it and then complete it in detail. And that helps us get organized so that we can prioritize effectively.
Can you describe what the template looks like?
Sure. We generally like to keep it to one page. It has sections for each of the major functions of the company. So, for example, there may be a section for the foundational work we do, which is the strategic intent document and the message map. There will be a section for corporate planning activities, which would relate to developing the board package that's going to be required every couple of months, the lender package that's required for compliance. We'll have a section on organizational development, and that may relate to process mapping that we'll want to do in the company. We could have a section on growth initiatives, which might relate to an acquisition that we've identified or new locations that we're contemplating opening. If we're in the provider services sector, there could be a section on payer relations. For any company, a section on marketing and brand development, regulatory matters, really anything that is an important function of the company where we want to capture key initiatives.
it's got to be a useful roadmap as well. It sounds like it outlines, documents all the different components of running the business, and in particular running a business that's now part of a private equity family. Sounds like it's got all of the components there on that one sheet.
It does. It also would specify who is leading each of the initiatives in each of the categories.
Roles and responsibilities.
That's right. Also timeframes, when we expect work on these initiatives to start and to finish. We generally think in quarters. And the reason we do that is to make explicit the prioritization, which obviously not only means what we're going to do first, but it also means what we're going to delay to a future point.
What about flexibility? Is the plan flexible in terms of inputs? I mean, you've said earlier, you are now dealing with, working with, partnering with entrepreneurs who have been accustomed to moving quickly, making changes on the fly, where flexibility has to be part, I'm assuming, of their DNA. Is the 100-day plan flexible in terms of inputs and potentially deadlines?
Yes, the plan's a living document. It's not just flexible. It's actually designed to be constantly updated, constantly referred to. And revisions around timeframes are a reality. Sometimes things take a little longer than we might like, and it forces us to make new prioritization decisions that need to be made to make sure that we are resourcing the most critical initiatives well enough to be successful.
So let's move to the strategic intent document, the second document that you mentioned. What is it? What's involved in putting that together? Who gets it done?
Getting it done is a very collaborative effort. We first of all begin by gathering any existing material from the company that would have related to company strategy, and we use it to generate a starting point template. Our team at Intandem has produced 40 or 50 of these documents over the years. Mm-hmm. And we leverage that experience while leading management through moderated drafting sessions. So we try and make it as painless and fun as it can possibly be. And we also take a really pragmatic approach so that the time commitment is not burdensome.
Help me understand, though, Elliot. You told me earlier that you have a shared strategy with the management, with the entrepreneur. That's what brought you all together, and there's an aligned strategy vision going forward, and that's the whole plan. What is then a strategic intent document? Why do you need something like that if you already have a strategy?
Well, going into the transaction, we have a high-level strategy. It's really a confirmation of our investment thesis, but there's not enough detail in the investment thesis to then allow the company to determine how to best execute. So what we need to do at the outset is go much deeper. And we begin by defining the mission and vision of the company. We describe in detail the marketplace positioning of the company. And that would be a function of specifying the product, the service, our audience, the channel, and also the uniqueness of the company. What are we doing different or differently than the competition that would motivate a patient or a customer to choose us? We then go on to describe the guiding principles that we want to see in place in the company. It's a set of principles that relate to the culture, the process, and the general environment that will help make sure that we are making decisions that are going to best serve the ultimate successful execution of the strategy. Finally, we may even try to make expectations explicit by producing a rules of the road document. It's meant to be a set of expectations that everybody should have of one another. Not sure if you've ever heard this expression, but frustration is almost always the result of unmet expectations. And usually those expectations are not overt. So people in companies, well, you could say in any organization, including in families, if they're feeling frustration, they're usually feeling it because somebody has disappointed them. They've not lived up to some expectation. But it's also true that that expectation may not be crystal clear to all parties. So we are trying to make expectations clear. And we're trying to reduce frustration and maximize effectiveness as a result.
It really sounds like communication. Is it fair to say that's the core purpose of the strategic intent document? It's taking that strategy, high level strategy that everyone's agreed on, but putting it down on paper, breaking it down, getting it just almost as literal as possible so that everyone knows this is what we intend to do.
Yeah, communication is huge. Once that strategy is really defined in sufficient detail, it's only as good as it is understood. And so there's a lot of time that's meant to be spent doing town halls and other kinds of meetings in the company to allow everybody to understand and ultimately buy into that strategy.
And I want to ask you about some of those communication mechanisms in a little bit, but two other things. One, you mentioned the need or the fact that you take a pragmatic approach to this, to creating the strategic intent document. Why does that matter? I mean, pragmatic, again, can be interpreted as counterintuitive to entrepreneurialism, to flexibility, to, you know, figuring it out on the fly. What's the reason and what's the importance of integrating and introducing pragmatism into the company at this point?
Well, these are tools that, if not used properly, could certainly be viewed as being academic. And the last thing we'd want is to waste anybody's time going through an academic exercise that will not result in better performance in the organization. So by pragmatic, what I really mean is we're focused on the most useful elements of these tools and to getting them completed in as short a time frame as we possibly can.
And I know I asked you in a different sense earlier, but same question. What's the reaction that you get?
Well, the reaction we get when we first describe the tools and the process that we need to go through to make them useful, healthy skepticism is something that we would expect to encounter.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, these tools are, you know, were never necessary in the past, and the company had been really successful, generally speaking, to get to that point. So, I say healthy skepticism because we want to make sure that, in fact, these tools are going to be useful and that they are going to create productivity. What we generally explain at the outset is that, yes, we're going to be spending some extra time on these activities, but part of the reason we're doing it will be to enable the company to go much more quickly in the future.
And what's the reaction that you get when that strategic intent document is done, when the entrepreneur sees it in, you know, in front of them? What do they say at that point?
Well, I'll actually go a little broader in my answer. When we get the 100-day plan done, there's a sense of relief that everybody can see on one page everything that's in play and that we can agree that we've got the most important items resourced well, and that we know where we're going to be focusing our time. Up until that moment, there could be a really uneasy sense of a million balls in the air. Mm-hmm. In terms of the strategic intent document, I think that it's generally embraced with a lot of enthusiasm as soon as we're into it. It becomes a really indispensable tool for organizing thought and communication in the company. And every time there's a new initiative that's brought to the table, it becomes a touchstone so that somebody on the team might say, well, hang on a second. I'm thinking of our market positioning cube, and this activity you're describing is outside of it. So why are we spending any time on it? And then the discussion becomes, well, either we shouldn't be spending any time on it, or we need to go back to that cube and really reassess whether we had it done in the right way. And it just promotes healthy, well-organized debate that generally leads to really good fact-based decisions, and ultimately to the quickest decisions that could be made in a responsible, fast-moving organization.
Elliot, do you have an example of a entrepreneur, like a specific reaction where that entrepreneur said, you know, oh man, I was really skeptical about this going in, Elliot, but now I can't believe, I mean, this is a map to our future. And it's just, this is an incredible thing to have this for all of us.
When we introduce these tools, they can sometimes be met with some healthy skepticism. But what we generally find is that once they're in play, they can be embraced. And I'm reminded of Dr. Marlo Hernandez, the CEO of Cano Health, the quintessential entrepreneur who, when we first met, would move faster than most people think. So the idea of generating an organizing framework for company strategy was almost antithetical to his day-to-day. But we went through the process of talking about why this would be important, how the company was changing, you know, why we had to set this foundation so that not just he and not just his team and not just the folks in South Florida, but that people in other regions could ultimately understand the strategy of the company and how we were executing it as well as anybody in his inner circle. So it didn't take long. Marlo's brilliant and he loves to learn. So he really dug in hard and took ownership of developing the document, worked with his team to do so. And it wasn't only a few weeks later that every couple of days I started receiving a new version, an update, more refined. And when he felt it was ready, he brought the entire team offsite for 2 days to do nothing but go through this and make sure it was as perfect as it could be, because the next step was then going to be to hold a series of cascading meetings throughout the organization so that everybody could literally get onto the same page.
And I'm not saying it was all because of the strategic intent document, Elliot, but how's Cano doing now?
Cano is doing exceptionally well. From the time that we had that first conversation that I described a minute ago to now, which has only been roughly 3.5 years, the company has grown close to 30-fold. So it's good that Marlo was not just willing, but enthusiastic about embracing a lot of these foundational tools, because it's been necessary and they've come into play every single day in a way that's allowed Marlo and the team to grow the company as quickly and successfully as they have.
So you've taken us through two of the tools, the 100-day plan, the strategic intent document, message maps. What is a message map?
A message map is the external version on one page of the entire strategic intent document. It's really meant to describe the company's value proposition to the outside world. Any message map will have a central message, a series of main points, probably 4 or 5 that explain that central message. And then each of the main points will have anywhere from 1 to 3 subsidiary points, and each subsidiary point will have a series of proof points. It's an incredibly useful document that will enable anybody to communicate and advocate for the company in any situation. It's also a source document for all external communication activity like the website, sales and collateral material, sales training material, advertising. It packs quite a punch for a one-page document.
How does the strategic intent document connect with the message map? How do they overlap, or perhaps more importantly, what are the key differences?
The strategic intent document is meant to define the strategy of the company in great detail in a form, in language that is suitable for members of the company to understand internally. The strategy, of course, implies a particular kind of value proposition, and it talks about how that value proposition is unique in some important ways. The message map specifically describes the value proposition that's implied in the strategic intent document, but does it in a way that's suitable for external consumption.
And earlier you talked about the central message. You talked about main points. You talked about proof points. Does that get confusing, or does that get really, really helpful because getting specific about messaging is what matters?
If it gets confusing, then it's not well designed. It's meant to feel natural. It's meant to feel easy to understand and easy to use. The central or the main message must be simple by design. So for Cano, the company I referred to earlier, the main message is we promote health through a comprehensive approach to primary care. Straightforward, simple, easy to remember. We have five main messages that support that. The first is that we have the finest clinicians. The second main message is our services are comprehensive and convenient. The third is our patients feel welcomed and well treated. The fourth is we place great emphasis on providing the best care very efficiently. And the last is all from a partner you can trust. So there are really detailed proof points that are associated with each of those main points I described. Not all of those will be remembered by everybody off the top of their head, but I think most people in the company, because this tool is really broadly and often used, most people would remember the main message and the main points around the main message and actually use it. So let me give you an example. If somebody were at a cocktail party and they were speaking with somebody who wanted to know more about what they did, who might even be in the business and might even be a potential source of referral of new patients, you know, they might say, is it true that you guys are hiring the best clinicians in the state? And, you know, without the message map, the answer might be, yeah, that's true. Which, I mean, it's a good answer. It's better than the alternative, but it's a lost opportunity if that's all that's said. So, a different approach with the message map training might be, yes, we do in fact hire the best clinicians in the state, but that's only one of several ways that we promote health through a comprehensive approach to primary care. So the map can be used to go inside out or outside in, but it can always be used to tie together a series of messages that make the most possible and most compelling case for why we have a winning value proposition.
And what an excellent example. I mean, it can be used in anywhere from the informal cocktail conversation that you just described all the way to the most formal marketing, strategic communications, documents, brochures, and all of that.
Yeah, for sure. It wouldn't surprise you to learn that the websites for our companies would typically track the message map. Or that the sales training material that we prepare for the sales function in the companies may have different chapters all organized around the different main points of the message map. So, yes, it is the foundational document for all external communication in whatever form, both formal and informal.
And, Elliot, as we move towards the close of this conversation, communications overall, I mean, you just talked about it, and it's what the message map is about. It's what that strategic intent document is about. It is, I would assume, in many ways, what the 100-day plan is about. I would equally believe, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that even with a clear strategic intent, even with a clear strategic intent and a 100-day plan, communication must always be a challenge for companies.
There's actually data on that. We know from many studies that a company will perform to its highest potential when its members, its staff members, feel like they can do their best work every day. And in order for people to feel that way, there has to be buy-in. There has to be great understanding of what's going on in the company. And leadership has a responsibility to make sure that that's in place. They have to capture the hearts and minds of everybody to create that level of inspiration. How can that be done without really effective communication? Impossible.
And so with really effective communication being almost at the center of leadership and management, what do you see as the core communications challenges that the companies you work with might have? I mean, you've seen all kinds of leaders, and there are some we know, some natural born communicators, and there are others who, you know, for whom it just doesn't come quite as easily. So what do you see? Are there any core communications challenges, maybe lack of process or consistency or a strategic approach to communication? What do you see?
In smaller companies, even mid-sized companies, systems for communicating efficiently in really complex environments typically don't exist. Fortunately, those systems have been designed and tested in lots of larger, high-performing environments. So what we've done is we've taken the best of, created a framework for a communication system, and then with each portfolio company, we review it and customize it so that the leadership team has a plan and has a framework that they can put to work. It's not just the responsibility of the CEO, although the CEO has to take the baton to make sure that effective communications are going on.
Sure.
It does start with the CEO, with the CEO's weekly staff meetings, with the CEO's weekly one-on-ones with direct staff. The CEO can model the right behavior for his or her management team so that the management team members then understand how to do effective staff meetings and effective one-on-ones. And that kind of activity cascades throughout the organization. But then there are all kinds of other sorts of communication methods that need to go on in different kinds of environments, from town hall meetings to a well-designed extranet to lunch and learns to skip-level meetings. They all have a purpose. They all have a different tempo that is meant to be followed. And, you know, we have the playbook. We just need to customize it, teach it, and then have it be adopted in the company. And it makes a really positive difference when there's a deliberate, planful approach to communication.
As you're describing these tools, is there an example of a CEO who went through, or a company that went through these tools and at the end of it just said to you, wow, you know, this process, you know, these tools have been really, really helpful?
Yes, there's something that just happened a few weeks ago that really makes me smile that you're reminding me of. While these tools are critically important, we also have to be careful about how quickly we introduce them. We don't want to overwhelm some of the other priorities that may be existing and obvious in the 100-day plan. So with this one particular company, we were feeling a little bit hesitant, but we decided to go ahead nonetheless, and we did a work session. We had a bit of trepidation as to how it was going to be received, because it took half a day and there was so much going on around it. But it seemed to go well. There was a lot of engagement. And the following day, we received a phone call from the woman who's responsible for client experience in all the clinics of this organization. And she told us that she could not stop thinking about this tool that we had gone through in the session, and that she had to pull over off of the highway, hopefully someplace safe, to take out a pad and paper and just start writing down all the ideas that it prompted. And the biggest idea at the end sounded something like, we need to take this tool and roll it out to every single member of this company as fast as we possibly can. So, you know, that's an example of going from, you know, oh my goodness, is this the right time? There's like a lot of hesitancy to take on new work to this is going to be the way we run the business. And, you know, while this was sort of a cute moment and a funny story, it really is representative of the way in which these tools are accepted and adopted and then applied throughout the companies.
And Elliot, as you know, each of us is a different type of communicator, and some, it doesn't have to just be a CEO, it can be any person. Some CEOs, some individuals feel really comfortable about communicating, and others, it's not their greatest skill. Do you have an example? Talk to me about a CEO who maybe wasn't the greatest communicator, but as you worked through the communications mechanisms, did that help evolve their approach? Did they get more comfortable? Any examples of CEOs that jump to mind?
Sure. Yeah. Communication comes easier to some than others. Having a framework for organizing communication, both your own as well as your team's, is a comfort for sure. But we go beyond just the mechanism when it comes to communication. We're coaches and we're mentors for the management team, in particular the CEO. So one of the things that we try to do is talk about the science of communications. And there is a science. There's neuroscience. And what we generally have everybody in a company do is go through a test, which is called the HBDI, the Herman Brain Dominance Index. And that test produces data that allows the management team to see the communication preferences of each of its members. Mm-hmm. And it uses neuroscience to help explain that people have preferences in terms of how they communicate. Some people like to understand the big picture. Some people like to understand the numbers. Some people like to understand sort of the stories and the feelings behind something. And others just want to know how to get it done. What's the process to get from here to the finish line? And everybody has preferences. Not to say that everybody can't do a little bit of all of that, but there are preferences. And in order to be an effective communicator, it's important to speak in the preference of your audience. So if there's a single person in front of you and they like to understand things with numbers, you better start with the numbers, have a lot of numbers, end with the numbers. And in doing that, you will be the most effective communicator you can. If you're talking to a large group, you can be sure there's going to be a mixture of everybody. So you have to make sure to offer the big picture as context, to talk about how everybody will feel as we're going through the project, to talk about the data that supports why we're doing what we're doing, and then to give the plan, the steps to get from A to Z. And in doing that, you will be able to hit everybody's preferred style and give a very good communication piece. So, you know, I won't go any further into that. There's a lot more I can describe, but I just wanted to give you that story so you can understand we're more than just about the framework and the organization. We will coach content as well.
It's really a number of opportunities for the business leaders, whether it's a CEO or whether it's a sales or a client experience manager, to continue to grow. As it's almost like a professional development opportunity, you know, in addition to it's more than just an investment. It seems like a professional growth opportunity.
It very much is that. That's part of our value proposition to management. But if I could also plug future employees of Intandem Capital, it's a great opportunity, especially for our young professionals, to come into an environment where they can work intensively with a limited number of great management teams and see the toolkit applied, learn the skills that are that are existing throughout all of these different frameworks and mechanisms. And in doing that, members of our team don't just become great investors over time because they understand the math. They become great investors because they get to understand the people and the processes and the companies themselves. And that is, in my view, also a great professional development opportunity.
That segues perfectly to the close of this conversation, because you just talked about a process, the process of setting the foundation. You integrate this process with nearly every company that you work with. It's an iterative process. I understand there's buy-in on all sides, but the process is part of the in tandem difference in the in tandem way. Why is it so important to you?
It's important to us because these elements that I've described and others like them are fundamental to establishing a foundation for growth. They're part of the infrastructure of a company that's necessary to grow responsibly. Without these elements in place, there is really, in our view, unacceptable risk that would be have to be taken on in pursuing a growth plan. You know, the great thing in our experience is that while you know we may come in with that understanding and that belief, and management may need to be exposed to the material to get up to speed, we've never once had a situation where a management team has rejected this approach, because it's essential and it's important, and in many respects, it becomes liberating for the management team to be able to leverage themselves, leverage their time, and then see a path, a more mechanical and predictable path to growth that otherwise would have been invisible to them.
Elliot, now that we've covered the initial what of setting the foundation, our next conversation will address the how. Give me a preview. What does that mean?
Sure. So by the what, you're referring to what are we trying to achieve? What is the strategy? What is the plan? You know, what are the key guiding principles that will help us get there? The how is exactly that. How do we design the organization to be able to be successful? So it has everything to do with operationalizing the strategy that's been defined. Here, too, there is a science that we put to work. In particular, we believe that once the strategy is identified, we have the opportunity to define the processes that need to exist to compete most effectively. We get to define the best way of doing every element that comprises the system of the company. We map those processes. And in doing that, we're also mindful that not all processes are created equal. And it's in our interest to prioritize those processes that make up our competitive work. So we know that the effectiveness of these processes will also need to be measured and defined with key performance indicators or KPIs. We also know that every one of the processes and each of their sub-processes will have to have owners. And their performance will in part be measured by the KPIs of the processes that they own. Process owners themselves need to have well-defined responsibilities. So we create performance models for every process owner that make expectations and accountabilities perfectly clear. And we have templates and great resources to help companies achieve all of this, which is critical to developing the infrastructure that's necessary to support a company's continuing growth.
Why am I not surprised that you have a mindful approach to every step along the way, Elliot?
Well, thanks for the compliment. There is a reason. This stuff is really hard. It's difficult to imagine a new direction that's going to require more than has ever been required before, and then take the leap from that imagined reality, you know, by manufacturing the bridges to get there. It's not easy. I think our management teams have an advantage in that they have partners who are willing to help them figure it out, who bring along a toolkit so that they don't have to start from scratch. And we've heard that time and time again from our management partners. You know, we know that we could never do what we do without them, but fortunately, they say the same about us.
And together you are building the bridges to get there, as you just said. Thank you for this conversation. I look forward to our next one.
Thank you too, Chris.